Earlier this year, I got the incredible opportunity to go on a reporting trip that took me to one of the most beautiful places on the planet, Patagonia National Park in the far south of Chile. The scenery there, it was almost scripted. Sharp peaks, almost always headlocked by clouds. The valleys were split with these aquamarine rivers. Vast grasslands dotted with guanaco, which is the wild relative of the llama. Patagonia was the last place that humans arrived in the Americas, and it's still one of the most remote places on Earth. When I was there, one of the weirdest things was discovering that there was no airplane traffic overhead. No contrails, no jet roars splitting the sky. Yet, at least for those who live there, it's the center of the world. And in recent years, it's also been the center of some controversy over how and whether that place should be preserved so that it will always remain wild and beautiful.
To create something beautiful is important because beauty matters.
On this episode of The Overstory, we're going to head to Patagonia to meet the American philanthropist who's at the center of one of the world's most ambitious rewilding efforts to create and maintain millions of acres of parkland in the far south of Chile. And we're going to get a chance to meet our new environmental advice columnist, Jessie Ann Choi, a.k.a. Ms. Green.
I try to make it so that people feel like they can do something, what might seem like a little action every day, all the way up to making a bigger difference, whether it's changing policies or signing a petition.
She spends her days advising the city of San Francisco on green policies and programs. And she spends her nights serving on the board of Earth Island Institute, a grassroots environmental leadership org. So basically, she's doing green activism 24/7. And for just a few minutes an episode, she's going to help us all do the same.
People have a lot more power than they might think they do.
Plus, we've got a conversation with the director of a small farming nonprofit that's got big ideas about climate adaptation.
Showing kids through the work that we were doing that you could take a blighted area and grow something beautiful.
This is The Overstory. Come explore with us. It's 8:15 on a summer morning in February, and the office of Tompkins Conservation outside the Chilean hamlet of El Amarillo is hive busy. The philanthropy's controller is hunched over a laptop filled with spreadsheets, and there's a supervisor giving orders to groups of men in blue coveralls. And in the middle of it all, toggling between a pair of laptops and her cell phone, is the intense but always gracious California-born 69-year-old Christine McDivitt Tompkins, the organization's president and the force behind today's important meeting.
Till 10 o'clock, I think, as soon as their minister arrives.
Chile's Minister of Public Lands is about to arrive, a television crew in tow. He's there to see some of the lands that Tompkins is set to donate to the Chilean people, an act of generosity that represents the most ambitious wildlands philanthropy in history.
Here's what your feelings are right now on, like, the verge of the handover.
I'm still in shock that we did it.
Just outside the busy office stretches a postcard-perfect view of Pumalin National Park. There's unbroken temperate rainforest climbing toward the glacial-topped summit of a dormant volcano. It was just a year earlier when Tompkins and then-Chilean President Michelle Bachelet announced a historic agreement. Tompkins Conservation would donate nearly 1 million acres of land. And in return, the government would put 9 million acres of southern Chile under new protection. In total, it would be an area larger than the state of Delaware, and it would create 5 new national parks and expand 3 others. So how exactly did an American philanthropist come to own almost 1 million acres of Patagonian wilderness and then donate it all back to the Chilean government? It was the consequence of a capitalist success, a love story, and a terrible tragedy. Back in the 1970s, Chris started working for a little outdoor clothing and gear company called Patagonia. Over the years, she eventually rose to the post of CEO, and she transformed the company into a global fashion icon. By 1993, she had left her position as CEO, and she married a guy named Doug Tompkins. He was the founder of another outdoors company you might have heard of, The North Face, as well as the co-founder of the global fashion company Esprit. By the time they married, Doug was already fabulously wealthy and just the other side of a midlife crisis. He had divorced his first wife and sold his stake in Esprit, which they had founded together. He made an estimated $150 million on the sale. Then he up and he moved to Chile to live in a ramshackle sheepherder's cottage on an isolated fjord in the middle of the Valdivian rainforest.
Sometimes, as we all know, life takes turns that you don't expect. And I bought a farm in southern Chile because there were very beautiful farms there, some of the most beautiful you'll find anywhere.
It was there, in the wilds of Patagonia, that Doug Tompkins became enamored with the ideas of Arne Naess, the Norwegian mountain climber and philosopher who had developed a system of environmental ethics called deep ecology. This led to a significant awakening and a shift in Tompkins' worldview. He decided that he needed to atone for his capitalist past, and that he would do so by buying up millions of acres of Patagonian wilderness in both Chile and Argentina. Here's Tompkins' old friend and business partner, Peter Buckley, talking about those early days.
And we took off in his little plane like we always do. And we were flying around, and he was like some sort of demented real estate guy. He goes, look at that, look at that, isn't that beautiful? I went, yeah, that's stunning. He goes, that's for sale. You know, we could buy that, we could buy this, we could buy that.
Chris joined Doug in Chile, and together they continued these massive land acquisitions.
He became his greatest self as he began to realize that modernity or the Industrial Revolution was creating a dystopia.
Doug always said he was buying these lands for nature, not for himself.
There are social responsibilities. Everybody is ethically bound by that, and it comes back to that paying your rent for living on the planet.
But Chris says that not all Chileans saw it that way.
Here's a foreign couple who come down and become, quote, the couple who cut Chile in half. And we didn't cut the trees. So we were amassing very large sections of forest and not cutting anything. So that's highly suspicious.
To Chileans accustomed to international investors who would come to the country only to extract its resources, it didn't make any sense. Then the suspicions became conspiracy theories. Wild rumors started to circulate in the Chilean media. Things like the Tompkinses were going to remove cattle from the land and introduce American bison. Or really kind of crazy stuff, like the land was going to be used as a nuclear waste dump, or a secret U.S. nuclear base, or, some said, a Zionist colony. The longtime superintendent of Patagonia National Park, a guy named Dago Guzman, remembers hearing some rumors back in the 1990s. He told me that there were all these crazy stories about a mysterious project that was going to take over Chile's lands and waters. But when he got to Pumalin, Guzman found himself fascinated by the project, and he ended up working with the Tompkins Conservation for the next 16 years. But buying up land was just the first step in a bigger conservationist plan. Next, the Tompkinses set about trying to enlarge the wildlife populations through an ambitious rewilding program.
Well, national parks, like I like to say, are the gold standard of conservation. They enjoy, in most countries around the world, the best legal protection for the landscapes and the wildlife there. So if you can, as a conservationist, can get land put into national parks, you really reach the peak of the pyramid in terms of conservation.
I got to meet a one-time sheep herder named Daniel Velasquez Romero, who worked there in the area when it was a big cattle and sheep farm. At the time, he said, the whole place was just dirt and earth due to overgrazing. Eventually, the Tompkinses won over many Chileans with their vision. According to what Romero told me, the park is the best thing that could have happened to the wildlife there. Not surprisingly, I guess, such radical ideas had their critics. One of those critics is Carlos Olivares. He's the president of a local campesino advocacy group. And he disliked the North Americans telling Chileans how to use their land. Olivares told me that the project wasn't done with the agreement of the local citizens.
Ese proyecto no fue con el acuerdo ciudadano.
That the Tompkinses ignored the local culture.
No tomaron en cuenta nuestra cultura, nuestro trabajo,
and the history of work and the economy.
Nada.
One could, I guess, see the Tompkinses' mission as a kind of paternalism, the belief that they knew what was best for the citizens of the region. But that would eventually change. In 2015, Doug Tompkins died in a tragic kayaking accident. He was out on a Patagonian lake with some pals when his boat capsized and he succumbed to hypothermia. After Doug's death, Chris turned her intense grief into action. She decided to fulfill their shared vision of donating the properties they had amassed during their marriage, of giving the land back to Chile as publicly managed wildlands.
Certainly his death focused me on this, probably saved my life doing these. Funneling that black hole into something that we both wanted so badly.
According to his friends and family, there's a line that Doug Tompkins used to say all the time. If anything can save the world,
I'll place my bet on beauty.
In the end, he did. His entire fortune. He even wagered his life on it and left his bones in the most beautiful place his money could buy.
To create something beautiful, just beautiful, is important. And maintaining things beautifully is important because beauty matters.
And what Chris and Doug wanted wasn't just a return to beauty or a return to wild landscapes. It's something much greater, a kind of peace.
National parks are not an end in themselves. We're after national parks as one of our strategies to slow down the species extinction, to make peace.
For The Overstory, I'm Jason Mark. If you want to read the full article, just go to sierramagazine.org. On our last episode, we heard from some young people who were at the historic climate strike in New York City. And we felt so inspired by them that we wanted to experiment with a new segment on The Overstory, where we can hear from young people who are taking action on climate change. We're asking them to record a memo from the field with a tip about how to get out, get inspired, and get involved. We're going to start with someone we met last episode, Daphne Frias. Daphne was an organizer of the New York climate strike on September 20th, and we got to hear how that strike day went for her. In the weeks since, Daphne and her fellow organizers have kept the pressure on local, national, and global leaders to take action on climate change. A lot of less experienced activists sometimes ask Daphne what actions they can take to make an impact. So we asked her to share her point of view with us. Here's a short voice memo from Daphne with something that any climate activist, a beginner or a pro, can do right now.
Something that I got a lot of feedback on was people wanting to continue actions and not just waiting for the next big protest. So today I'm here to talk to you about something that I did to create climate action in New York City. I knew the thing that I really wanted to tackle was having New York City declare a climate emergency. So I went ahead and looked at my local city council representative and I sat down and I began to write him a letter. So in my letter, I spoke to him about the buses in my neighborhood because we have a huge bus depot there. I also talked to him about the water treatment plant that was in my neighborhood because it exhausts fumes that pollute our air and makes it really hard for people like me with asthma and respiratory issues to breathe safely and comfortably in their environments. So the first couple of times I got sort of a generic response where they have their secretary say, I acknowledge the receipt of your letter. Thank you so much for writing to us. So I kept on pushing. I kept on sending the letters and I got creative with the letters. I made stickers and I drew pictures and drawings. I made it unique as possible. I put sticky notes on my letter and I would say, hi, you should read this letter because if you live on planet Earth, you're affected by the climate crisis. I sent my letter 63 times, and I finally got not only a letter response, but a phone call from my representative, and he spoke to me and said, how can we help you? How can we do something about this? And how can we work together to declare a climate emergency? So find your local representative. Our elected officials really do work for us, and the way that we can make them do their job effectively is by having open and honest communication with them. My biggest tip is to write from the heart. Talk about your personal experiences with climate change and then ask them directly what you want them to do about it. I hope to hear how you two are changing the world.
That was Daphne Frias. You can find her at Frias underscore Daphne. That's F-R-I-A-S underscore D-A-P-H-N-E on social media. If you've got a climate action tip or trick to share, contact us. Just send us an email at overstory.podcast@sierraclub.org for a chance to be featured on this segment. We'd love to hear from you. As a lifelong resident of Richmond, California, Doria Robinson grew up with a Chevron refinery looming over her city. Now, in the oil refinery's shadow, she runs a farming nonprofit called Urban Tilth. At first, the nonprofit set out to teach young people how to grow food at the urban farm. That is, until a fire broke out at the refinery in 2012, forcing the nonprofit to change course. Sierra Magazine's senior story editor, Wendy Bechtold, talked with Doria about how the nonprofit has grown increasingly involved in working against climate change.
Can you tell us what it was like growing up with the presence of this refinery so close by?
I mean, it's funny because, you know, when I was growing up, I grew up on 5th Street and 5th and Evan in Richmond. And literally out of my window, the view out of my window from my childhood bedroom was the refinery. It was just monolithic. You were kind of just at its mercy. And you just be kind of generally upset with it. But there's not anything you could really do. So it's just like this kind of deep cynicism, like in my mom or in my aunties or in my grandparents, just like deeply cynical, knowing that, you know, every time there'd be a fire or every time there'd be some kind of, you know, something that happened, the flaring, the constant flaring, this just the dirty air, the soot that's on like all your things in your house and on your windows and on your car if you leave it for a day. You're just like, you know, just generally upset, like generally just angry, like, why do they get to do this? And I can't really do anything about it. Throughout my lifetime, I think I consciously remember three big incidents. One when I was a child, I remember the skies going kind of red and sirens, you know, going off. And, you know, it was this kind of whole shelter in place thing. We were like, Mom, what's up? And after a while, we came out to find that the paint had been eaten off of our car. We went through the whole, you know, what happens usually when there's an accident in Richmond is that they'll open up these offices so that you can put in a claim, right? So everyone's like, I'm about to get my money after, you know, something like that happens. And, you know, again, it's like this very cynical thing. And then everyone goes stand in line or whatever. My mom did the same thing. She's like going to get her car repaid. You know, they owe her type of thing. Months and months and months later after this thing happened, this check comes in the mail with some, you know, tiny amount, like, you know, $500 or something like that, and barely get the car painted again. And I remember her opening up the check and just, again, just saying in this kind of like snide voice, like, yeah, this will pay for the car, but what are they going to pay me for my lungs? You know, it just really made a huge impression on me, you know, of this underlying threat, you know, this underlying damage that's constantly being done. And for the first 7 years of our existence as Urban Tilth, you know, we're hyper-focused on health and food and nutrition and eating habits and obesity and heart disease and things like that. And not so much involved with, you know, kind of air and water and our environmental justice issues. But this particular summer, we had one of the biggest classes ever in the summer apprentice program. So the kids had grown a ton of food. We were growing new things. We were growing at 8 different sites. It was just a big year. And literally the day before graduation, the fire happened at Chevron. And just this feeling of being there, being in one of the gardens and looking up, and like, we spent the whole summer convincing kids, showing kids through the work that we were doing, that you could take a blighted area in Richmond and grow something beautiful, something healthy, you know, that they could do it, that they could transform their own situation, that they weren't locked into this, you know, this negative, nasty future. And then the refinery blows up and spews this cloud of, at that time, we were like, we have no idea what's in that cloud, no idea. It's most likely toxic. And the kids were like, all of our work is ruined.
we can do whatever we want to do to try to change our lives, but ultimately corporations like Chevron, these bigger entities, have so much more control over us, and we're really at their mercy. And they got pissed. They were really angry. They're like, this isn't right. They're like, who owns the sky? Why do they get to own the sky, you know? And they decided that they were going to rip out all of the produce because they felt like it was unsafe to eat. And they're like, we're going to pull it all out and we're going to go to the Chevron community meeting. We're going to dump it on their stage. We're going to say, you're responsible for this. And basically, you know, hold our own protest. And that's what they did. And it kind of created a really strong commitment to environmental justice and environmental work within Urban Tilth, that fire.
And it sounds like it really changed the conversation for you at Urban Tilth.
Right. So before the fire, we were really just a community garden organization, you know, interested in teaching kids how to plant and how to grow and how to water. After the fire, the gardening really became a metaphor for the much deeper work that we are doing, and opened up a whole other area that we now are completely committed to around climate and around just environmental justice, just the, having the right to be in relationship with land, having the right to say that even in Richmond, that land, those people, our people, us, deserve to be protected. So what I hope is that through our work at Urban Tilth, we can demonstrate how you could create a regionally local food system, one that shortens those supply chains, that reconnects urban centers to their rural counterparts. So, you know, in our little urban farm is kind of a, we hope, a beacon or a magnet for this kind of interest and energy. So we grow food here, but we also connect with farmers in East Contra Costa County who want desperately to keep their farming lifestyles, to pass it down to their kids. So we connect with them. We bring food into our farm. We distribute it with two people who are most in need, you know, at prices that they can afford. So this is not free. We're actually wanting to actually develop an economic system around this new regional food distribution that employs people at fair wages and passes along that retail price to farmers, you know, through this direct distribution. So that's what we're trying to do, is we're actually trying to remake these smaller regional growing distributing systems that connect people back to the land, connect people back to farmers, connect people back to their economies, and try to make a life that's really worth living.
That was Doria Robinson speaking with Sierra's own Wendy Bechtold. For more information on Urban Tilth, visit urbantilth.com. That's urban, T-I-L-T-H.com. I'm really excited to be able to introduce Sierra Magazine's and The Overstory's new environmental living advice columnist, Ms. Green. And that's Jessian Choi.
Hi. Hi, Jason.
Jessian, I'm so glad you're here. You're going to be, as our longtime advice columnist, Mr. Green, was doing, offering people tips and hints about how to tread a little bit lighter on the earth. But I learned about you, I think, first because you had this really cool blog called Fun and Draconian.
That's where I post tricks on how to create an equitable green world. Also had tips on how to be happy and vegan and still have friends.
Is it hard to be vegan and have friends?
I actually find it makes me a much more generous person. I'm always bringing food, and I just love to see the looks on people's faces when they do like what I bring. So it's made me a better person.
Fun and draconian, I guess the sort of take is that you want it to be easy, and I guess not to feel like you're, as it were, eating your vegetables, to live a more environmentally conscientious lifestyle.
I try to make it so that people feel like they can do something, what might seem like a little action every day, all the way up to making a bigger difference, whether it's changing policies or signing a petition, trying to make people feel like they have a lot more power than they might think they do, and trying to make them laugh at the same time.
And you also have this really deep background as a real kind of environmental policy wonk, right?
So I, by day, work at San Francisco Department of Environment, where I help co-create laws, some of the strictest laws in the nation. And we also do a lot of research on less toxic green products.
And I guess you'll be bringing those research skills to us here at Sierra Magazine and the Overstory to really help people suss things out, because a lot of these questions are not as straightforward as they might seem.
Right. And a lot of times the answers are not on the internet. And I don't always just trust what manufacturers say, because I've been around too long.
So let's go to one of our Ask Ms. Green questioners. This is Julie from Washington, D.C.
Hi, Julie.
Hello.
What's your question?
So the issue of environmentally friendly sanitary products. There's definitely a lot of eco-friendly options out there, which I'm aware of, but perhaps you could give us a little bit more info about those. And then also, especially the reusable product, is that actually more eco-friendly by the time you throw them through the washer, run a separate load for them, and does that actually amount to a significant gain for the environment? Is it really worth it?
Well, surprise, surprise, my answer will not be single-use items. I don't know if you know, but in 2015, the Ocean Conservancy collected almost 35,000 used tampons and applicators on beaches in a single day. And I'm that person that actually took photos of ones I've seen on beaches. What I find to be the greenest and also the most comfortable is period underwear. I don't know if you are familiar with that kind of product.
I'm not.
Oh, well, it's just like regular underwear, and it doesn't give you what I call the everyone knows I'm wearing that a diaper look and feel. It's just like regular underwear, except it's leak-proof. What I do is I wash mine with cold water that I collect in water dispensers that I have in my bathroom while I wait for my shower to get warm. So that's how I work around that.
Oh, cool.
So it looks like I have drinking water dispensers in my bathroom, but they're actually not for drinking.
That's a fantastic idea.
Yeah. There's some pretty ones out there online. Like, you can get fancy, like fancy wedding-looking water dispensers if you want.
So then you wash them in the sink by hand then?
Yeah, or sometimes I wash them in the shower. It's definitely like, you know, very meditative, I guess.
Yeah, because I was picturing running a whole washing machine load for a few reusable products, and that just seemed like kind of a crazy business there. But, of course, hand washing had, for some reason, never occurred to me.
Mm-hmm. And when I say hand wash, like, it doesn't take a lot of time. Really, I'm just rinsing, and sometimes I use soap. But really, after you rinse it, all you have to do is you can throw it in your regular laundry.
That sounds actually almost more convenient than the non-reusable ones, because it saves you having to go out and restock and saves you all of the extra worry, and you've convinced me.
Well, thank you so much for your question and for calling in.
Thank you so much for answering it.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Well, Jesse, thanks again for this segment, and looking forward to having you on the next episode of The Overstory.
Thank you so much, Jason.
That was Jesse Ann Choi, a.k.a. Ms. Green. She's our new advice columnist at Sierra Magazine and here on The Overstory. You can talk nerdy to her at sierramagazine.org. Just go to the top of the page, click on green. Green Lifestyle, and scroll down to Ask Ms. Green. You can also follow her on Twitter, at Real Ms. Green. On our last episode, we featured the voice and story of April Pearson Keating, a clean water activist in her community of West Virginia, and the daughter of Iris Bell, who wrote the state song, This Is My West Virginia, which April happily sang for us. Right after we released the episode, we were saddened to learn that April Pearson Keating has recently passed away. Ms. Pearson Keating spent her life as a tireless advocate for clean water in her community, which has suffered from the health effects of mountaintop removal coal mining. West Virginia and Kentucky lead the nation in deaths per capita from cancer, and recent studies have shown a direct link between cancer and the air and water pollution due to toxins from strip mining. In response to this epidemic, April founded the Mountain Lakes Preservation Alliance and the Buckhannon River Fest. She was also a founding member of POWER, Preserve Our Water Heritage and Rights. She was a board member of the Buckhannon River Water Association and a board member of ICARE, a cancer research group, a board member of the West Virginia Environmental Council, the West Virginia Highlands Conservancy, and the Ohio Valley Environmental Council. April died of breast cancer on Saturday, September 28th, at just 52 years old. She's survived by her husband, her two sons, and her daughter. Thank you, April, for all of your work to make your community and this planet a better place. Lynn Ringenberg had been a pediatrician in Florida for over 20 years when she started seeing some troubling patterns in the kids coming into her office.
I realized in my private practice so many kids, younger and younger and younger, with asthma. I didn't see that back, 20 years ago.
And it wasn't just asthma. There were also behavioral issues, even some showing up as early as just a year old.
I see more kids with developmental disabilities than I ever saw in the first 20 years of my practice. And I saw more kids coming in for their well baby checkups that actually had mild hearing loss, other kinds of behavioral issues. And I said, this can't be genetics.
It was an alarming trend, and it caused Lynn to found the Florida chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility, a nationwide physician-led organization that's working to protect people from the health effects of climate change. We sat down with Lynn and PSR Florida board member Maria Scambotti to learn more about their work, the challenges, and the promises of hope.
It's hard to make this definitely causes this. That's very, very hard. There aren't that many things.
The process by which those causal connections are made are very complex and very difficult to do, but necessary work, because I think to some extent science and policy are interrelated with each other. So it's critical that we study the epidemiology of exposures to certain chemicals, whether that's particulate matter in the air or understanding what fracturing might put into our drinking water, and then understanding the human health impacts of that. That's sort of why I got involved with PSR, but the truth is that I love the planet.
Our only reason to do this is our love of the planet, yes, but our love of our children and grandchildren. When you get in front of a group, I kind of start off telling them that I'm a doctor and I take care of kids like you. And I also take care of the earth, and the earth is really sick. And we went through about 30 minutes or so, and at the end, I gave them all a little globe, a little earth ball, and I said, okay, now you're all doctors now. You all have to be doctors of our planet, so you and your families can grow up and live in this beautiful place that we have. This was middle school kids, really cute kids, and they would walk around saying, I'm a doctor of the earth. they're so cute.
The thing that gives me the greatest hope is when I see young people engaged. Is because then I know, so there are a lot of the next generation is engaged in this.
That was Maria Scambotti and Lynn Ringenberg from Florida's Physicians for Social Responsibility. You can learn more about their work at psrflorida.org. The Overstory is produced by Josephine Holtzman and Isaac Kestenbaum of Future Projects Media, with help from Daniel Roth and Reva Goldberg. Special thanks to Kaylin McCarthy. Our theme music is by Jeff Brodsky. This episode was mixed by Dara Hirsch. I'm Jason Mark, and you've been listening to The Overstory. It doesn't matter if you're a regular subscriber or a first-time listener. I hope you'll take a minute, go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from, and rate us. It'll really help.